Hi everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Corporate Chat Podcast. Your hosts for today are Mathis Grandchamp and myself, Loïc Meunier. We're both pursuing a Bachelor of Commerce at McGill in Finance. Thank you to our sponsors, Deloitte, Cementov Development LTD, and Red Bull. Our guest for today is Barbara Svan, President and Chief Executive Officer at University Pension Plan Ontario. UPP manages over $10 billion in assets and is responsible for the retirement planning of 39,000 working and retired members across four Ontario universities, such as Queen's and Toronto. Barbara was named Canada's top CEO and Corporate Citizen of the Year by the Globe and Mail in 2022. Our guest holds a bachelor from McMaster University and a master's degree from Waterloo University, both in math and statistics. She's also a fellow of the Society of Actuaries. And without further ado, our fascinating conversation with Barbara Svan. Hi, Barbara. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How about you guys?
Great. Thank you so much for coming. We've been looking forward to having you on the show. Let's talk a little bit about your academic background. So you did a bachelor and a master's in math and statistics. Why that choice and what was your career plan then?
Yeah, so as a young person, didn't really have that much clarity on my career plan. I was going into university. I really liked math. It was a strength in terms of subjects, but I wasn't all that sure where it was going to lead me. And then one day in second year, a professor came up and made the suggestion to write some actuarial exams. And that led me to an internship at Mercer, which is an actuarial and consulting benefits firm in Toronto, which was neat to do at that age and kind of really opened my eyes to the possibility of doing more in the financial sector, but I couldn't tell you at that time exactly what or how or where, but definitely tweaked an interest.
And right after you finished school, what was your career like? Then pursued your master's degree. What was your early career like?
Yes, my master's degree was in math, and I during that program, even though the master's was in math, I started to get into investments in finance, and I focused my project on it. And then I was also working through my actuarial exams, which fortunately at that time they started to introduce a fair number of exams on investments, and they developed an investment track, which kind of aligned with my interests. And then post-masters, I received a role at one of the large banks, and I was actually pricing currency options. So this is a long time ago. This is pretty early on, and there's no master's in mathematical finance at this point. But it was a great learning experience, one, to really see a big corporate environment, and two, to learn it wasn't necessarily for me.
And also, we read that you just spent under 25 years at the Ontario Teachers Plan. So how did the opportunity to work there come across?
Yeah, so it was really interesting because, I started when I was at the large bank, started to hear Claude Lamoureux speak, and he was, picked up in the newspaper, and he was describing what his vision was for Ontario Teachers. Ontario Teachers. So this at this time, Ontario Teachers is not the Ontario Teachers Pension Plan that people know today, which is a sophisticated global investment organization. But at that time, it was just transitioning from a government-run administration organization, and pretty much the assets were in provincial bonds. That was it. And so, he communicated how he was thinking about, striving for providing excellent service to members, building trust with members, building a professional investment organization that focused on delivering the pension. And so it kind of checked all the boxes, met my actuarial background, investment interests. And as a leader, Claude was obviously a visionary and passionate, purpose-driven. And I know purpose is often spoken about today, but you didn't really hear it a lot back then. And so when I was at the bank, a colleague that I worked with at Mercer was now consulting for them, and he recommended me to them, and I jumped at the chance to take the role. And I entered a team called Research and Economics in 1995 as an assistant portfolio manager. And really, that's kind of how it started. But it was a great career journey.
And can you tell us a little bit about the rest of your career path at Ontario Teachers Plan and how it led to your opportunity at University Pension Plan Ontario?
Sure. So, you know, walking into an organization like Teachers, again, it was much more of a startup than what it was today. You know, you got to work no matter what level you were on a whole sort of issues. And so I was able to see a lot of big picture issues and be in the room from pretty early on. You know, I got to work with some great mentors, so Claude Lamoureux, Bob Bertram, Jim Leach, and Ron Mock. And, you know, so early on, what my focus was really to work on the investment plan. So these investment plans would happen once a year, and it would kind of lay out the plan for the year in terms of how you're going to move assets. And, you know, back at this time, was trying to figure out how do you move a portfolio that was 100% non-marketable Ontario debentures, so basically Ontario bonds you could not sell, that matured $1 or $2 billion a year, and the last maturity wasn't until 2012, and move that to help build a diversified portfolio. So at the beginning, I got to be involved, and then over time, I got to lead that, which was amazing. And then, you know, I was involved in developing the risk budgeting framework that's spurred on the active management programs, thinking about how you design liability-driven investment programs, you know, the introduction of leverage and formalizing the debt program, and just to name a few. And then throughout time, I also got to work with what's known as the sponsors. So that is the Ontario government and the Ontario Teacher Federation. And most people don't think of them necessarily as part of teachers, but they're a key part of the governance of Ontario teachers. And they make really critical decisions on contributions and benefits that impact the long-term sustainability. So my job there was to help them with those decisions. And so that also brought unique perspectives. You know, I was asked to, you know, along the way, there's something called the global financial crisis in 2008. And I was asked to become the chief investment risk officer at that point, which evolved to a chief risk and strategy officer role. And like many financial institutions in the early 2010s, spent significant time on projects to improve the risk measurement capability, advance the risk culture. And then at the same time, I got to join the executive leadership team, which is an amazing experience to really learn every aspect of running an organization. And then at that time, you think you move past all these things, and then you really started understanding environmental, social, and governance issues, or ESG, and getting into sustainability, first through G, because that was commonly the first focus, and then moving into environment and social, which led to climate change given its systemic nature. So given all that experience, when UPP was looking for a CEO, I guess they called me.
And you also sat on Cadillac Fairview's board. At the time, you were at Ontario Teachers Plan, one of the largest owners, operators, and developers of commercial real estate in North America. I'm curious to know, what was that experience like?
Yeah, so it's a great experience in terms of, I would recommend anybody as they move through their career to become a board member. Because normally as senior management, you work with a board and you're providing the board material. But to take the other seat and to become a board member and work with management, it's a really interesting experience on what you're not doing well when you're management. Right? Because how do you help board members that come in every so often and, you know, provide the right level of oversight? Cadillac Fairview was also a really important part of the Ontario Teachers portfolio. So getting that right in terms of what were the characteristics that we were looking for was an important aspect that I brought to that table. But I would say, you know, the biggest learning from being part of that is how to be a better management person with a board.
Yeah, thank you. And now shifting gears towards the market segment. University Pension Plan Ontario oversees the registered pension plans of Queen's University, University of Guelph, and University of Toronto. Can you walk us through UPP and its history?
Yeah, so I came in 2020. And, you know, really at that time, what my job was to create the organization. And if you recall, at that time, there's something called a pandemic. And UPP was really at this point, it hadn't received its full regulatory approval, and there was no team, there was no office, there was no bank account. And I can tell you, it's quite hard to get a bank account when you don't have a CFO or a lawyer or a phone number or an address. That was, you know, from 2020, it's been a big part of how do we build the organization. with really a one-year time frame to take on some of the biggest responsibilities. So it really spurred on ingenuity, getting the right people in place, taking all those learnings that we collectively had from being at other pension plans and applying it to UPP. But UPP actually started maybe 10 years before I did. Back when we had the global financial crisis, most pension plans in Ontario, Canada, and globally, experienced significant losses. And across, Ontario, the university sector wasn't spared. And they were, those pension plans were defined as something called as a single employer sponsored pension plan, which meant that every university or employer is running these on their own and in isolation of each other. Which meant after the losses of the global financial crisis, it led to significant contributions because they were under a framework that was really designed for public companies or companies that were running pension plans. And it was very focused, if this company went away tomorrow, is there enough monies in the pension trust to meet the commitment that has been earned to date? That makes the time frame a lot shorter, a lot more volatile in terms of what you need to contribute, because it looks much more at current interest rates and that sort of thing. And what they wanted to do was actually move to something called a jointly sponsored pension plan. And a lot of the large pension plans in Ontario are a jointly sponsored pension plan, and across Canada, a lot of them are, but they're just called slightly different things. And what's the really unique thing about a jointly sponsored pension plan is two things. One is joint governance. So single employer pension plan run by the employer. A jointly sponsored pension plan, it's the employer working with the employee groups. And so basically everybody's at the table making those key long-term sustainability type of decisions. And so members are at the table through their representatives and the universities are at the table. Also, the other part thing that they need to share jointly is risk. So if there is losses, it is shared generally on a 50-50 basis between the members and the employers. And with those two things, you can become known as designated as a jointly sponsored pension plan, which means the funding rules of which are applied to you become much more long-term focused, much more on long-term planning, which helps manage through these more turbulent times. And that was one of their goals. But then you're probably going, why did it take 10 years? Right? And it's a really good question. But, if you look into this period as two halves, the first period, there was no regulatory framework on how to convert a single employer pension plan into a jointly sponsored pension plan. It just did not exist. You could open up the regulations and you could not find any information on what type of approvals do you need? What type of approvals do you need from your membership or from the regulator? So all that had to be created. And then you had to go through all the different design elements, right? So how do we, what's this benefits going to look like? What are the type of contributions that we're hoping to target? So all that work had to be done, and there's a lot of different stakeholders. So when you start doing the math, it makes sense that it took that long. But on July 1, 2021, we were actually able to bring five pension plans together across three universities. So that was Queen's, University of Toronto, and Guelph. And today we also have Trent faculty and other participating organizations that are all related to the university sector. So we're almost at 40,000 members and about $11 billion asset under management.
Wow, super interesting. And as an investor, Matt and I recently started reading a book from David Swenson. And as an investor responsible for all those university pension plan, what are your thoughts on his approach, and what would be your philosophy regarding the investment of this portfolio?
Yeah, so I remember reading that book a long time ago too, so it took me back. Great book, so recommend it for anyone to invest the time in reading it. But there's some key concepts in there and principles. I think one is, diversification and really maximizing the opportunity to diversify your portfolio. So thinking of it in terms of, the best risk-adjusted return that you can earn. And that often means going into new or non-traditional asset classes. And those are really the founding principles that I embedded in a lot of my efforts throughout my career, including at UPP. So for UPP, He was focused on endowment. Our goal is to deliver a secure, stable pension income to our members today and tomorrow. So compared to our endowment, our liabilities are different. They're a very long horizon. We often say they're generational. So think of it, someone comes in, they could be 25 or 30. We might have them in this pension plan for 60, 70 or plus years. So we are really, truly a long-term investor for our member. So that means, you know, two things is how we think about it. One, we have to meet that return expectation. So pension plans have to probably earn somewhere in the target of 3.5% to 4% after inflation, just generally as a ballpark. So that's a number that, you know, you need to take risk to take. And therefore, you know, we also focus on resiliency because we need to think about when we have those events like the global financial crisis, right? How do we improve our ability to weather through those turbulent times, right? Because ultimately, you know, the things that change, which are contributions, which impacts pay, what people can take home, or benefit levels, you know, that's hard for individuals in university to absorb. So we're trying to minimize the number of times any of that has to change. And I would say most pension plans have that same type of philosophy. So we really think about the portfolio in terms of how does it perform in different economic environments, being very focused on diversification. So practically, a good example is, you know, when we brought the assets together, there was very little private assets in this portfolio. And private assets, you know, bring a lot of benefits in terms of diversification, but they also bring inflation hedging properties that you don't find in other assets. So think of infrastructure or real estate. It also helps us with the scale that we have to, you know, focus on responsible investing and ESG or environmental, social, and governance. And these are complicated topics and they really matter over the long term to your outcomes. So scale is very helpful, you know, to be able to have those subject matter experts who can really unpack the complexity. So that's really important to have that talent in place. And as many large pension plans, you know, they're cost effective with scale. We're a mid-sized pension plan. And so we're focused on internalizing select capabilities. So we go through cost benefit analysis, just like any other company would. And we looked at, you know, assuming we can bring the talent in, you know, simplest form, can we do it internally for less and still have the same or better outcomes? And middle, kind of taking out the middleman, is kind of the simplest way to think about it in these pension models.
So you mentioned stable, low risk, adjusted return, diversification, inflation hedging. Would you say that sums up your approach and philosophy regarding your investment portfolio, or does it differ from this?
Yeah, so we need to provide inflation hedging into our pension. We need to provide that 3.5% to 4% rate of return. And, you know, we have a lot of interest rate sensitivity. So these are all, you know, key risks that we need to think about and how we could build our portfolio. So today, you know, we're still in the transition of moving to a new asset mix. But today we're probably what we call 60-ish percent return enhancing. So you would find this information, by the way, in any of our annual reports. You know, we're probably 40% in public equities, and we're building our portfolio in private equity that stands about 6%. Our private debt portfolio and our absolute return strategies are both about 9. Our interest rate sensitive portfolio is roughly at 40%, and we're looking at the duration and trying to match that to the liabilities. The inflation sensitive is at 6% because we didn't receive a lot of this asset class from the incoming university. So both infrastructure and real estate. So that was an immediate focus to bring in new assets there. We've closed 5 new funds within our 2 years. So we're pretty excited about that. And also having leverage in the portfolio of about 9%. So that's kind of where the asset mix today, but areas of focus is to continue into those inflation hedging assets and still, you know, bring in more diversification opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Moving on to the next question, you're also chair of the investor advisory group of the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board. Can you tell us a little bit about your role there and what is it exactly trying to accomplish?
Sure. So I'm a chair emeritus, because that is now part of the International Sustainability Standards Board, but SASB, or the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board, started back, call it roughly, I think 2006, when Bloomberg Foundation gave money to help develop a suite of metrics that focused on environment, social, and governance that were material to financial outcomes. So that financial materiality lens of these metrics, right? So investors, this is important to investors. It had an investor advisory group, which they would lean on to say, are we in the right ballpark? They did a lot of consultation. But this investor advisory group that I was chair of also had a really important role in pushing for adoption. So we would engage with companies, and I was the second chair. So a big part of my role was to get this group as big as possible, right? They started producing metrics and standards, and we really wanted this group to be as big as possible. So as a collective, we can say to companies out here, this is what we need. So both in terms of how do we make investment decisions, but we also wanted to provide companies clarity on this is what investors care about. And so that was my role there, is in leading that group in terms of providing feedback to the organization, but also getting this group as big as possible so we have the strongest collective voice as possible.
Mm-hmm. And moving back to the portfolio more in overall, in the overall aspect, what's your approach to ensure you have the correct amount of liquidity? You know, because it must be a critical aspect of the management of the overall fund to give this sustainable income to your members.
Yeah, absolutely. Liquidity is really important. So people often think of liquidity with pension plans. You have a long-term horizon. You know, you can go into these liquid asset classes. Absolutely. But from a risk background, you know, most of the pension plans also use derivatives. They also have the need to provide collateral to, you know, as your derivatives go up and down in value, you have to make payments. And so as you have a portfolio that part is illiquid, part's requiring this collateral on a daily basis, you really need to think of the liquidity of the fund. And so, you know, you need to look at it when you, with a couple different lenses and a couple different ways. So you have to be proactive in terms of when you're doing that investment planning, I need to look over the long-term horizon. Am I going in a direction where I'm going to have the liquidity I need to meet all these payments, including when markets go down, like in the global financial crisis, right? So there's a lot of planning, scenario analysis at that time that go over a long horizon. And then you have to think about, well, I have shorter term shocks. I need to monitor and make sure the people who do this on a daily basis have the information they need. So you put in place something that has, okay, if we have these shocks, do we have enough liquidity to meet them? And this is done every day as these checks and balances go through. So those are the proactive pieces. The reality is you're going to have these shocks. So you really need to be ready to react. And so, you know, in my past life, we often would simulate a crisis and put people in the room and say, do we have real clarity? Do everyone have what they need? You know, where are we getting stuck so that when we have the event, everyone knows what to do? And usually it's never as you plan. And usually the thing that's difficult is when more than one thing goes wrong. So you really have to incorporate those thought processes as you do your planning.
And in the 80s, you know, there were fewer hedge funds, fewer private equity firms, and that number has just been proliferating over the years. So a new challenge has emerged, which is that now you have to choose from the pool of a high number of hedge funds and numerous amounts of venture funds, B funds. Making the choice within allocation seems to become more difficult. And even when you do find a good fund, you're not competing with other LPs to put those millions, billions there. So I guess my question is, how do you approach that aspect of capital allocation?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And something definitely I saw proliferate over my career. So one of the things that we actually decided to take in-house is that manager due diligence. How do we select a manager? Often people rely on consultants. We decided to bring in experienced talent that have done that for a living, mainly for this reason. How do you really look at managers critically, both from, you know, do they have the capabilities? So am I going to pay them active management fees? I want a high confidence that they're going to actually deliver on those, you know, earn those fees back and more. So you literally, practically, you look at hundreds of opportunities from the lens of, will they truly add value? And what's their fit within the portfolio, right? Is it doubling up on something we already have? Does it add diversification? So you really look at it technically from those two lenses, and a lot of analysis goes into that, including today in many of them, looking at the lens from responsible investing. How are they incorporating those notions into their portfolio? But you also, you know, you're going to develop a partnership with these managers. So you also have to look at the leadership of those organizations. How will it change? How will it evolve the governance of those organizations? And then you need to even send in what we call the operational due diligence team to make sure that all those controls and financial controls that you rely on to say how much money is there and need to be in place. So you look at a lot of analysis and getting to know that manager from all those different lenses before you're really putting a recommendation. So you literally go from hundreds that you look at to a few that you actually end up recommending. Your other part of your question, though, is how do we make UPP attractive for those managers? And, you know, that's a great question. Often people don't think about that aspect, but we really think of ourselves that we need to be a good partner to the managers that we work with. You know, part of that is, you know, we need to be very clear on what we're looking for. Our actions have to be consistent with that, and we have to be responsive. So, you know, often in the private equity space, you do something called a co-investment. You know, you need to be there when they ask you for, do you want to participate in this co-investment? You know, your answers need to be consistent with what you've told them in the past of what you're looking for, and be able to tell them fairly quickly, are you interested or not? And if you're interested, you know, making sure that you're doing the diligence at the pace that they need, you know, the pace that this, you know, works through, right? Not necessarily at the pace that you want, right?
Mm-hmm. And before we wrap up our discussion on markets, we have last one question for you. What trends and practices practice areas are you most excited for, looking forward to in 2024 and even beyond?
Yeah, so for 2024, I think, you know, we're at this point where investors really want clarity around, you know, sustainability topics. So we can go into all the ways that Canada is globally, but you know, we're at a point where we need to make some of these critical decisions so that, you know, we can move forward in Canada as well as globally on, you know, material, environmental, social governance metrics, as well as on things focused on climate change. You know, I talked a little bit earlier about, you know, Sustainability Accounting Standard Board. It's actually evolved now, and it's under the accounting practice of the International Sustainability Standards Board. And this is a big step forward because, you know, think of accounting standards. All of you probably studied some form of accounting. It falls under IFRS. You know, basically, it's putting the same due diligence and oversight on sustainability metrics that we have on accounting metrics now. And they've, you know, taken the work that investors led on Sustainability Accounting Standards Board, as well as the equivalent on the climate change side, the Task Force for Climate-Related Financial Disclosure, and brought them up. So this is all information that's super important to investors. And I think we're at the cusp of it making the next big leap forward. And I think, you know, all the CEOs of the large pension plans have really reinforced this going forward. I think in terms of the other thing I'm excited about, so we often talk about, you know, there's a lot of opportunities now happening with the theme around climate change. You know, you think in the US with the Inflation Reduction Act, you know, we're seeing lots of great opportunities there. You know, there's a wide range of them. There's not just the what people think of solar, but there's digital aspects. You know, how do you help companies in the last mile around the batteries, et cetera? There's lots of great opportunities that we're starting to see and take advantage of.
Yeah, it's really good. And now moving on to the mentorship section, are there any specific skills that are particularly valuable in the pension plan world?
I think, you know, if one thing with the pension plan is in financial institutions compared to other ones, it has the longest time horizon. So if you're a person that likes to think about long-term opportunities, think about, you know, what are the risks in those longer term timeframes, a pension plan would be a great place for you.
And what advice would you give to your younger self?
Really understand the power of connections and network, right? Everything gets done through people. So invest the time in getting to know the people that you work with, the people that you work with at other organizations. You never know when that next opportunity comes from also. So also the power of a network. I would say, you know, be very open to a variety of experiences. It helps build out a bigger toolkit of skills for yourself. Will help with the next experience, brings more people that you can meet. And so I think, you know, always be open. I never said no to when, you know, Claude or Bob asked me to do something. It was like, okay, how can I help you get what you need done? And I would, the last thing I would say, watch the masters. So, you know, especially as a young person, I always watched how people got to alignment in the room. So whoever is trying to manage, you know, difficult different points of view, how they landed on the decision, and really being adaptive to, you know, different people, different situations. And I think that's really a skill that you need to practice, especially as you want to move up. And so my suggestion at a young age is to watch the people who do it really well and make a note of what they're doing differently to actually get to those decisions.
And what would be your number one advice for someone looking to work into the industry?
Yes. So given you folks are in university, I would say, you know, first and foremost, get your technical skills, get that base, get your credentials, you know, get that behind you, right? You having those credentials, whichever ones you want, you know, gives an immediate check for ARC that you have the credibility and you have the capabilities. So suggest, especially at the younger ages, get past that. The next thing is, you know, the ability to work in a group. Nothing happens in isolation. Everything is in a group. So we're always looking for people who have experiences to that. And that could be in school projects, that could be in volunteer works. It really helps to also illustrate if you can be adaptable to different situations. The other one I would say for a lot of people, especially if they come through a technical area, is work on those communication skills, right? Not just in a small setting, but in presentations, written, you know. And this is one of my experiences when I had to actually deliver material to the board, and then being a board member receiving the materials, that was an eye opener. So how do you create materials that are effective for what you're trying to get done? And don't think you always have to explain every technical bit, right? So it is a skill that you need to practice. So, and take the opportunity through, you know, different projects or volunteer efforts to do that. And the last thing, I would prepare for the interview. You know, why are you interested in joining this pension plan? You know, do your research. What's unique about the different pension organizations? Why are you attracted to them? And be ready to let the person who's interviewing know that.
Mm-hmm. And you also talked a lot about building a team. And what could you talk a little bit about your internship program and how does it shape your overall organization?
Yeah, so I'm pretty proud of our internship program. And so it's kind of a natural being involved with the university sector that we wanted to invest in a good internship program. So we usually have somewhere, depending on the time of the year, you know, it could be 5, could be 20 interns. And we really try to make sure that everyone gets to know each other during that work term and really, you know, network, learn from each other. And so we also try to make it so that you are, we give you a dedicated program manager from the talent area of our organization, and they guide you through your work term, provide you advice as you go through. And we also assigned you a buddy to help coach and navigate you through your work term. So you don't ever feel like you're in a situation where it's like, how do I manage X, Y, or Z, especially if it's not technical related, that you have somebody early on that you're introduced to that you can, you know, have lunch with, bring up these situations, ask them how you would have handled it. So hopefully provide some learning opportunities. We know work has to get done, but we also try to make it fun. And so, you know, we structure the work experience so that there's also opportunities for socials amongst this group. We find that people often come back to organizations because they have friends here. And so we want to make sure that the interns look at UPP as a long-term opportunity. So we make sure that there's enough social elements to it as well. And I hear with the interns that the snacks are really popular as well as the coffee machine.
And moving on to the rapid fire questions, what is the best piece of advice that anyone has ever given you?
Yeah, so maybe I'll reframe that question as what were some aha moments that stopped me in my tracks. So I would think back to, you know, being in a leadership course, and we had to pick a project. And they said, list all the things you need to do to get this project done. So everybody in this, you know, leadership course will list all the things they had to do, you know, and they're often were tech or process related. And everybody missed the people part. And then, so they asked the question, so how will you get this done? Through whom will you get this done? Right? And that was the aha moment where you realize, wow, I didn't spend enough time building these trusted relationships, and I'm not going to get this stuff done without the help of these people. So I would just say, think about the people aspect as you think about getting stuff done.
Yeah, definitely. Everything is built around people. And on a scale of 1 to 10, how important would you say your GPA is as a student?
Yeah, so someone with a master's in math, I'm always going to tell you numbers are important. But out of 1 to 10, maybe 8, it's important, but it's not everything. I think it's equally important to be well-rounded, be curious, demonstrate that you're a continuous learner. And at UPP, I would say we're always looking for people, and we kind of coined it, and it was picked up once in the Globe and Mail, as the Swiss Army knife person. So people who have a lot of different skill sets to bring to the table and are willing and are flexible.
And if you wouldn't be in the financial industry, what would you be doing instead?
Probably something in the impact space. I find that really interesting as that space is evolving. You know, it's probably a decade or so behind kind of ESG in general. I think there's a lot of opportunity to prove that you don't need to take concessions on those returns. So watching with interest, and right now I get to be a board member of McConnell Foundation, so I get to tweak my interest that way because they have made a commitment to go to 100% impact in their investment portfolio.
And we mentioned David Swensen earlier. You know, what is one book you would recommend for a listener?
Oh, I have more than one book. So if you let me go on for a tiny bit. So if you're interested in sustainability, I would say there's one quintessential book you should read is Silent Spring by Rachel Carson. It kind of goes through that whole acid rain and other destructive things we used to do to the environment and how it impacted people as well. And it talked through how long it took and the commitment it took to change that. So it's quite inspiring if you're working through a lot of these climate change type of issues. More on the investing side, there's two. I would say if you're interested in understanding how you integrate investing with sustainability, there is a great book called Moving Beyond Modern Portfolio Theory, Investing That Matters by John Lukanoknik. I probably didn't get that completely right, but so it is a great book because I think all of you probably learned modern portfolio theory in school, and it really goes to all those assumptions and really looks and critiques them and say what's missing. Over the holidays, I also read Too Close to the Wind, Why Credit Suisse Had to Go Down. Punchline or spoiler alert, it was because of poor culture and risk management. So if you are going or thinking of going into a financial institution, I think that should be required reading for anyone to really understand why culture and why risk management is so important to embed within a financial institution. And for the career side, there's a great book. It's called The Invisible Rules, you know, what's really holding women back in business and how to fix it, by two authors, Holly Cataflamo and Paul Herrietta. So what they did is they interviewed 50 women in Canada that were successful and pulled out key themes. But most importantly, you know, they kind of put a framework together of if you want to advance in your career, what do you need to do? And they called it the CAPS framework. And it's about capability, adaptability, promotion, support. So it's a great read. The book is based on women, but I think the insights are completely universal. And I think it would resonate with people with a broad range of backgrounds. So I think it's great for any student to read.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being so generous with your time, Barbara. We really appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the show. If you like what you heard, feel free to drop a comment or follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or our social medias. Have a good one and see you next time.
The sole purpose of this podcast is to educate and to inform our listeners. It is by no means a substitute for professional guidance by qualified experts. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute financial or other professional advice or services. Instead, we encourage you to discuss your career options, as well as financial undertakings with other professionals who specialize in wealth, securities, and asset management, or any other field in financial services. The information, opinions, and recommendations presented in this podcast are for general information only, and any reliance on the information provided in this podcast is done at a personal and individual risk. This podcast should not be considered professional advice. Guests who speak on this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. The views expressed on this platform are personal opinions and only, and should not be construed as financial advice for a given situation or from a given institution. While all attempts are made to present accurate information, it may not be appropriate for specific circumstances, and information may become outdated over time. No firm, nor any company providing financial support, endorses or opposes any particular view or tools discussed in this podcast. This podcast is available for private, non-commercial use only. Advertising, which is incorporated into, placed in association with, or targeted towards the content of this podcast is forbidden. This podcast may not be edited, modified, or redistributed. The Corporate Chat Podcast has no liability for any personal activities in connection with this podcast or for personal use of this podcast in connection with personal websites, computers, or playing devices. Moreover, the Corporate Chat Podcast makes no warranty that this podcast or the server that makes it available is free of viruses, worms, or other elements or codes that manifest contaminating or destructive properties. McGill University and our sponsors expressly disclaims any and all liability or responsibility for any direct, indirect, incidental, special, consequential, or other damages arising out of any individual's use of, reference to, reliance on, or inability to use this podcast or the information presented in this podcast.